From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. The rift between the United States and Israel has worsened, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel scheduled to address Congress on Tuesday. Netanyahu's appearance is opposed by President Obama, and some congressional Democrats have said they will boycott the speech. In New York, three men who aspired to join the terrorist group ISIS in Syria were arrested, and officials alleged they also had targeted President Obama, police, and Coney Island for attacks. And in northeastern Syria, hundreds of men, women, and children in one of the world's oldest Christian communities were seized by ISIS. Well, I'm going to start very simply, Tom, with this really much worsened rift between Israel and the United States. But let me start with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who was invited by House Speaker John Boehner to address Congress. Why did Benjamin Netanyahu accept? Now, the White House knew about it ahead of time, hadn't approved it, but he accepted. He had to know that the White House and the president in particular, with whom he doesn't get along very well, would be upset.
Well, I don't think he cared, Fred, because I think this was largely a domestic political calculation on Netanyahu's part. There are elections in Israel in March. I think he thought that this would be helpful at home. Whether it is or not, we'll know in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it was motivated by the fact that, as you said, he and President Obama don't get along. To put it bluntly, I'm told they can't stand one another. And they give lip service to the notion of, not lip service to the notion of the strategic importance about the alliance between the U.S. and Israel. They obviously believe that and they understand that, but I think their personal animus towards each other gets in the way. And to me, it's somewhat amazing that there are some in this White House who, not openly, but a little too incautiously, are hoping that Netanyahu loses this election. Mm-hmm. So presuming that a more moderate Israeli government would come aboard. But I think the personal bad blood between these two heads of state, heads of government, is really incalculable, and it's gotten in the way of the relationship, I think.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that has always been a constant in the U.S.-Israeli relationship is how it can't be broken, that the president always says there's no daylight between us and Israel, that these two countries are two countries that cannot be torn apart. But apparently they can be torn apart on a personal level. From a strategic level, we see, well, you know, the United States is still providing large amounts of aid. You know, from a security perspective, Israel can still depend largely on American security guarantees. But on a personal level, there is a sense that you feel that there's a disrespect here, that Netanyahu is disrespecting the president by not going through previously established channels to say, hey, I got this invitation, I wanted to give you a heads up, and, you know, are you okay with it? For a country that's much smaller than the United States and receives a lot of help from the United States, you'd imagine that would be par for the course.
But let me follow up on that with the White House, Tom. And it would have been par for the course. On the other hand, the White House has made a huge deal out of this. As you were suggesting, White House aides, or at least administration aides, have leaked very nasty comments about Netanyahu. The White House encouraged the Congressional Black Caucus to claim that by accepting this invitation and giving this speech, Netanyahu would be disrespecting the president, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal has declared this, at least on its editorial page. This speech is now the speech of the year. Certainly, President Obama didn't want that to happen.
No, he did not. I mean, the speech has now been magnified as a result of all of that. But I also should point out that there is a fundamental strategic component to this fight, other than the fact these two leaders don't get along, and that is they have a fundamental difference on what to do about Iran. And I think the reason why Netanyahu is going to take all the heat that he has and will take for this speech and is going to do it is because it will give him a huge audience, especially a congressional audience, to make the case that the U.S. government is minimizing the threat of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And this is, I think, a problem for the president for the obvious reason that talks between the West, notably the U.S., and Iran have been going on for a few years here, and they're reaching a flashpoint. Sooner or later, and probably sooner, these talks are either going to bear an agreement or the U.S. is going to have to walk away from these talks. And I think Netanyahu is consciously trying to turn congressional support against Iran and, by definition, against the president's policy. And the president has said, we can't do anything legislatively about Iran. We can't impose new sanctions on Iran because the talks will collapse. And so I think Obama and Netanyahu have much to gain and much to lose from this speech. But on balance, I think Netanyahu understood that it was going to cause him real problems with the U.S. government, but it was important for him to be out there talking tough on Iran a few weeks before the election.
Do you think, Tim, that it was a mistake for the White House? Not to be upset, I understand that. Your point was a good one earlier. But to make such a flap out of this.
Like, a lot of this is just about ego, right? So on a personal level,
at least some of it, yeah.
At least from the White House perspective, they feel that they have been wronged on a personal level, that they didn't get to approve the dinner party invite or something like that. I mean, there are important strategic points to this, but a lot of the leaks are human.
Yeah,
That people feel personally aggrieved about it.
Yeah, well, they think, obviously, strong elements of the Obama administration, the president on down, really don't like Netanyahu. It's the president personally, but they don't like him politically or geopolitically or anything, Tom.
Well, I was just going to add, Fred, all three of us have been in situations where sometimes you get information a little too easily, and it was it was amazing to me, just from a talking shop standpoint here. This is not the world's most open White House. Their information release is grudging at best, and yet the day after this speech was announced, it was with lightning speed that the White House officially noted that President Obama did not plan to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu when he was here, and they blamed that on domestic politics. The press spokesman, Josh Earnest, said it would appear that President Obama would be taking sides in the Israeli election, and that was very inappropriate. Now, that may be technically true, but there was almost relish in the speed with which this information was put out.
But Tom, what about the agreement on the Iranian nuclear program? It sounds like most of the concessions have been made by the P5 plus one. It sounds like the Iranians have been the masters of the negotiations. Maybe I'm overstating it.
Well, I don't know if you are or not, but I think you're right in terms of where these negotiations are. It just seems to me, not knowing anything specific, but it seems to me that these negotiations are down to whether the Iranian negotiator, the foreign minister, can persuade his religious superiors, the Ayatollah and others, to go along with this, that it's now kind of on the Iranian domestic internal political table. And you talked about it's not a treaty. Of course, many Republican senators believe it is a treaty, and that they claim that the only reason President Obama is calling it an agreement is that then he doesn't have to submit it to the Senate for ratification, because whatever you call it might be in trouble if it had to be ratified by the Senate, which all treaties have to do.
I think the president's right about this. You know, there's some the president can volunteer to do it, but to send it to Congress, which he's not going to do. But I think technically, and I couldn't run through all the technical facts here, but that it's not a treaty. Anyway, Tim, it's not a treaty, but there is an effort in Congress. It's mainly Republicans, but not just Republicans, who want him to send this deal to Congress for its approval. The president has said, or at least his White House staff has said, he will veto any bill that comes to him that would require him to send it to Congress for ratification or approval. It seems to me that that's going to create somewhat of a controversy.
Well, yeah, and for now it seems that Senate Democrats are willing to go along until perhaps the end of March in order to see what kind of agreement actually gets reached. You know, there were a lot of discussions earlier this year and even now about imposing sanctions that would drop if there was a failure to get an agreement, thus increasing pressure for the Iranians to come to an agreement and for the United States to reach one. And that has been postponed. I mean, I think that Senate Democrats just were not ready to go against their president, and they were willing to give this idea of strategic rapprochement with Iran a little bit more time. I mean, the Obama administration just believes that it's not just about this nuclear deal, that there's a long-term strategic interest in being able to work with Iran on any number of things, and that this is the first domino to fall in a long series of events that could change, for example, the nature of relationships in the Middle East. You know, Iran is a big supporter of the Assad regime, for example.
In Syria.
And it's also got its hand in a lot of Iraqi militias, which are now trying to push forward and defeat ISIS. So the Obama administration does believe that if it could just get this nuclear deal behind them, it could solve all sorts of other geopolitical problems that have long been an issue. Now, whether you agree with the Obama administration on that, whether you agree that they're desperate to come to a deal so that they could get to these other problems, is another question entirely.
Tom, one final question, and it's this. You'll remember back in 2004, 2005, 2006, how much French President Jacques Chirac disagreed noisily with President Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq. And yet, or so I've read, that a level below this disagreement, French and American intelligence and national security advisors and so on got along well to keep the countries, while there's a disagreement at the top, but just to keep them as allies, to really work on that. There doesn't seem to be that going on right now between the U.S. and Israel.
No, I think the bad blood is the worst it's been in all the years that I've been here. I remember in the George H.W. Bush administration where Secretary of State Jim Baker had a congressional committee and a hearing and basically accused the Israelis of not being interested in peace. And he very famously said to the Israeli government, if you're interested in peace, call us. Here's the White House phone number, which the Israelis just went crazy about. But that, I think, was the low point. Up until this point, I think this is the worst. And you get the feeling that the Obama administration is not going to have anything to do with Benjamin Netanyahu if he is, in fact, reelected. So if that's the case, then that augurs even more poorly for the state of the relationship for the next 22 months.
Okay, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click it on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Are you an iTunes user, Tim? You're younger than the rest of us.
I have an iPod.
You do. Well, I have one. I just can't find it. Let's turn to these. Well, I used to use it when I, you know, would work out. But anyway, my question now is to turn to these three young men who were arrested in New York City, and they were seeking to go to Syria and join ISIS. They'd also, at least police say, they uncovered at least intentions by these three men to attack the president, police, Coney Island, and so on. And what this sort of touches on is ISIS leaders have sort of farmed out terrorism and say, let's have some. And we have that example in Australia where it say, look, do it on your own. You don't need to come here.
And in Canada as well, for example.
Yes, Canada as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the deep problems of ISIS and its propaganda victory since its beheadings of Americans last summer, is that ISIS is an ideology that doesn't require formal logistical networks or anything like that. It requires an internet connection and a willingness to listen, right? And so we've got these three guys in Brooklyn who were trying to perhaps become jihadists in the Middle East or to conduct acts of terror here in the United States. But really, these guys are kind of more like the Three Stooges. They're online. They're saying, hey, we're in the United States. We're looking to commit some acts of terror here. You know, think we can do it? I'd like to, you know, please try to assassinate the president. That's basically what they're posting online. That's how the Secret Service picked them up. And these are not sophisticated people, but we've realized, I think, in the past year that terrorists don't need to be particularly sophisticated to do a lot of damage and create a lot of fear.
And they can be, as Tim was suggesting, they can be attracted and persuaded to join ISIS in some way just by going online and hearing propaganda speeches and so on.
It really is. It drives the Obama administration and all Western intelligence agencies crazy because it's really the subcontracting of terror on the local level.
That was the word I was looking for.
Subcontracting. Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine the other day was thinking about where his son should go to college, and he says, I want him to go to some small liberal arts college in the Midwest because nobody's going to strike there in Iowa or Kansas or suburban Montana. And the fact of the matter is you just don't know. The subtext of terror is a terror attack, no matter how small, how modest, still can carry a huge punch, and it makes it very difficult for governments to cope. But the good news, of course, is the Secret Service and other counterintelligence agencies were watching these guys, and they found them, and they had them. And whether or not they were just talking tough, and I mean, you can be sure their defense lawyers will say, well, they were just mouthing off. It was not for real. The good news is they were caught. They were exposed. But these things happen all the time. I mean, the recent example of three British schoolgirls who apparently have gone off to Syria because they want to commit jihad, and they are in Syria. So, I mean, it is a problem, and it's a problem we're going to be dealing with from these microphones, and governments are going to be dealing with for a long, long time.
Let's turn to these hundreds of Assyrian Christians who've been grabbed by ISIS, which is certainly scary, since many of the people that ISIS grabs, they wind up killing one way or another, burning to death or decapitating them. And this is one of the oldest. Well, there are a couple of issues here. Let me go to the second one, which is this is one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East. Christians are being driven out of the Middle East, where historically they have lived thousands of years, and yet it hasn't become that big an issue in the United States with the media, I think around the world. Tim.
Right. Well, it is getting new life, though, now. I mean, I think there's been a lot of media attention on the kidnappings of Assyrian Christians by ISIS. I think the broader question here is the one that you were getting to a little bit earlier, which is ideology and the resilience of ISIS despite the American efforts to kind of push them back. You know, the latest estimates are that the United States have killed some 6,000 ISIS fighters. But at the same time, because the United States is essentially fighting an ideology, 4,000 fighters have flown into Iraq and Syria in about the same time frame. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a replacement rate that's very high, and that ISIS's actual fighting strength is not decreasing as dramatically as the United States might want it to or might imply it to. You know, we talked a little bit about the four London schoolgirls who went off to Syria. There are also four from Montreal. It was announced earlier this week that four Montreal students were on their way to Syria as well. I mean, this is a ideology that I think attracts people who feel that they're left out of their own society, who want to fight against modernity, and that's the most resilient part of it.
Tom, you know, I was struck by the fact that these Christians were grabbed in northeastern Syria, you know, by ISIS. And that is a long way from Baghdad, where ISIS is also, what, 10, 20 miles from Baghdad. I mean, they have control, or at least are active in a huge area of Syria and Iraq now.
Yeah, this is not just a modest uprising in a localized area. I mean, the other thing about attacking the Assyrian Christians is this particular area of Syria is one of the world's oldest Christian communities. And the New York Times talked about some of those who were taken prisoners speak a modern version of Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so you don't often see, especially in a paper as august as the New York Times, a paragraph on the front page that called this latest attack a rampage reminiscent of Tamerlan or Genghis Khan. Mm. And also I think the video images of ISIS partisans defacing and destroying ancient Assyrian artifacts, I think, is a very galvanizing psychological moment. Whether it leads to anything remains to be seen. But the problem is, as Tim says, is that, which I think the U.S. learned in the Vietnam War, is you cannot bomb your enemies back to the Stone Age and be sure that it's going to be effective. Mm-hmm. And we will be talking at these microphones in many weeks and months ahead about how many more, or whether any American combat troops will have to be sent to these areas because it looks like the moderate Syrians, however you define them, mm-hmm. aren't going to be ready to fight for months at best.
I thought you were going to say something else when we might get to a situation where an American soldier is actually captured by ISIS and obviously threatened with decapitation or something. That
well,
would be
a soldier or mm-hmm. or airman. I mean, mm-hmm. Clearly, an air campaign, which is basically what's going on right now, mm-hmm. is theoretically a little more antiseptic, and it's also safer for pilots. But that was not the case with the Jordanian airman who mm-hmm. was captured. And I think that would really be a real problem for the United States if U.S. soldiers and U.S. airmen mm-hmm. were somehow captured by ISIS. That would be quite a turning point.
All right, one more issue. We have several minutes left, and there is an annual conference in Washington called the Conservative Political Action Conference, and all the Republican presidential candidates come, and they get enormous attention. It's a lot of media and so on. And yet, Tim, the actual primaries and caucuses are a year away in February of 2016, much less the election of a new president in November 2016. I continue to wonder why there are so many candidates running on the Republican side anyway, and they're getting so much attention. There seems, my own view is, there are a lot better stories for the media to be covering than that one. It's so early.
Well, you know, I mean, there are actually not really technically any candidates for the presidential campaign. None of them have announced that they're running, although there are a lot of proto-campaigns and suggestions that they will.
I'll say there are a lot of them, yeah, but it's still early.
Yes.
And I'm not going to this conference, but an awful lot of people are in the media, Tom. I mean, you've covered, and you may have covered even more presidential campaigns than I have, but maybe one more. But anyway, what do you make of all this?
Well, it's just the prospective candidates crave the attention. But more to the point, the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, these are conservatives whose power has escalated in the Republican Party in recent years, and you cannot ignore them. You cannot ignore their clout in the party. And so anybody who aspires to be a Republican presidential hopeful has got to appear before this group, and we'll know in a few days or so what the party line is on who did well, who did poorly, who overachieved, who underachieved. But I agree with you, it's way too early, and anything that happens at CPAC, even if you did well or poorly, is not fatal. I mean, as you say, it's how many times have you heard me say, and you, I know you agree, overnight is a lifetime in politics.
Right.
Well, we've got a year's worth of lifetimes before the Iowa caucuses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's early. So anything that happens to a Republican prospective hopeful mm-hmm. now, good or ill, is basically irrelevant. I mean, nothing's really going to change until people announce, until there's voting in mm-hmm. Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, the early primary and caucus states. We're a long way away.
The other thing is what they do may be irrelevant, but it's also not predictive. In other words, there'll be a straw poll and somebody will come in first, and that person is in no way assured or even aided, I think, in winning the Republican presidential nomination next year. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA corruption correspondent Jeffrey Young. Our topic on this edition of the program, Saudi Arabia and its links to extremism. Our guest, Janet Breslin-Smith. She's the author of a forthcoming book about Saudi Arabia, tentatively titled Two Sides of the Veil, Living in the Mystery of Saudi Arabia. Janet has a long and distinguished career in public service. Before going with her husband, Ambassador James Smith, to Saudi Arabia, where he served from 2009 to 2013, Janet was a professor of national security strategy for 14 years at the National War College within the National Defense University here in Washington. She was the first woman to chair the Department of National Security Strategy. Prior to her academic career, Janet served for over 17 years in the U.S. Senate, first as a legislative director to Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, and then as deputy staff director of the Senate Agriculture Committee. She is currently launching Crosswinds Strategy Consulting and assisting Saudi women professionals in career development. On this edition of the program, we'll explore the recent political transition in Saudi Arabia, the death of King Abdullah, and the passing of the torch to King Salman, as well as the significance of the educational and other reforms implemented under King Abdullah. We'll also discuss with Janet Breslin-Smith the linkages between the narrow-minded brand of Islam promulgated by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the brutal ideology of the so-called Islamic State. And Janet Breslin-Smith joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol. It's good to be here with you and out of the cold.
And I'm delighted to welcome back my colleague, Jeffrey Young.
Glad to join you.
Well, Janet, we're so happy to have you here to talk about your years in Saudi Arabia and particularly a very interesting opinion editorial you wrote for the New York Times late last year entitled The Struggle to Erase Saudi Extremism. But first, I want to ask you to talk very briefly about your distinguished career, your transition from Capitol Hill to your position at the National War College.
Thanks, Carol. And again, it's great to be here, especially when I talk to young Saudi women right now and young American women. My career is in some way reminiscent of what Saudi women are doing in terms of the fact that I graduated from college in 1967 and went into a PhD program in national security. And at that time, I was one of the first women to go into that field. And when I came back to Washington as an intern, actually, as many young people are doing now, for Senator Alan Cranston from California, I had the opportunity to experience politics and the legislative process. And it so captivated me, I actually changed my academic focus from international law, which is where I thought I was going to develop a career. And I got Potomac fever and ended up working then, as you mentioned, on the Hill for about 17 years. And so I had the opportunity not only to do defense and foreign policy issues, Senator Leahy was on the Appropriations Committee, but also when he became chairman of the Agriculture Committee, I had the unique opportunity of learning all about soybeans and dairy cows and parts of agriculture that certainly growing up in an urban area, I didn't have that much contact with. But at one point, a man came up to me that I knew on Capitol Hill and asked me if I would give a lecture at the National War College about how Congress works. And I was happy to do that. And when I went over to Fort McNair, which is only 5 minutes, I think, from Capitol Hill, I was impressed not only with the institution of the War College, which was started by Dwight Eisenhower in 1946, and what a remarkable place that is, but the opportunity to explain to military officers exactly what Article 1 of the Constitution is and how it works, since they're devoting their lives to defending our Constitution. So that's how I made that transition. My background was in international policy and strategy. The Hill gave me, I think, a grounding in our own system. And then for the rest of that half of my career, I worked with teaching and actually engaging with our military officers in a program that presents dilemmas. And certainly the experience of living in Saudi Arabia was another dilemma for me to puzzle through.
Which takes us then to your time in Saudi Arabia where your husband was posted as ambassador just until a couple of years ago.
Right.
Briefly, your impressions of Saudi Arabia.
King Abdullah had been in office in his position for maybe 2 or 3 years before we got there. He had started this education program, and I was there at a point where I could meet and get to know over a long period of time. We stayed there 4 years, longer than most ambassadors stay in a position. And so I had the opportunity to really get to know these women in a deeper way. And then, as I will probably talk about today, puzzle over these issues that they're contending with themselves.
Yes, indeed. And I want to get to that. And before I turn to my colleague, Jeffrey, let me get to the very point of this interview, which is the subject of your opinion editorial, the struggle to erase Saudi extremism. As you know, last week, the White House held a summit on countering violent extremism. There was some reluctance on the part of the White House to make the direct connection that you're making, which is this, that the rise of the Islamic State has once again turned the spotlight on Saudi Arabia, which is accused of supplying the ideological foundation of the movement's brutal ideology, as well as many of its fighters and funders. Please elaborate.
It's interesting. The issues that you raise, the Saudis themselves are having to contend with among themselves. And shortly after the president had his conference, there was another conference. In fact, there's a series of conferences going on right now in the region. And leaders, both clerical leaders as well as political leaders and military leaders, have been coming together over this period of time, not only to talk about the military situation that they face, but again, to me, it's the beginning of a deeper reflection about this relationship. King Salman himself has made certain statements recently. The head of Al-Ansar University in Cairo has also made certain statements just in the last few days about the need to reflect on both education, in terms of religious education. And there is a general concern, I think, across the region. What is the relationship here with the way children have been raised, the way the religion has been presented, and what they're seeing right now in these young, mainly young men, some women, who are engaged in the activity that Daesh or ISIS is doing. And so when I talk to Saudi mothers and fathers, there is a deep concern to really trying to get their arms around themselves. And as I say, it's a difficult question because it's forcing them to look inward and question themselves, what has this led to?
Indeed. And of course, we hark back in 2001 when the kingdom faced similar criticism, as you said in your opinion editorial, after 15 of the 19 hijackers in the 9/11 terrorist attacks were found to be Saudi. So let me turn to my colleague Jeffrey Young to talk about this unfortunate linkage.
The classic linkage between the throne in Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabis dates back to the agreement by which Saud took power, the House of Saud, in 1935. The Wahhabis, if not disturbed, if not challenged, if not provoked, would support the throne. In return, the throne would kindly look the other way for certain activities that the Wahhabis were involved in, such as spreading an extreme form of Sunni Islam, not only through the Arabian Peninsula, but throughout the Islamic region, all the way to Pakistan, where we still see echoes and reflections of it today. This is how business is conducted in that part of the world, and there's historical basis for it.
Exactly, Jeffrey. So the question for you and, of course, for Janet is, are the Saudis, with the new King Salman, and given the advance of the so-called Islamic State, are they seeing that this is a major threat to them and finally waking up and doing something about it?
What we're seeing now is their own game coming back to haunt them. For years, the Saudis and rich Gulf thrones as well, so it's not exclusively the Saudis, but the Sunni thrones of the Arabian Peninsula have for years subsidized and supported various extremist movements in parts of the Middle East and elsewhere. Finally, as the extremism looks back at Riyadh and says, now that we are so big and strong, you know, we can take you as well. Suddenly, now all of a sudden, we hear this loud gasp in Riyadh, and they say, we're under threat. And where might that threat have come from?
I guess I want to step back a bit. This is not the first time these types of dynamics have happened. As an American, you hear the year 1979, and we tend to think of the Iranian Revolution and what happened with our diplomats being held hostage. It was also a traumatic year for the Saudis.
A very good point.
There was, again, a very charismatic man who had a following, who also at that point felt that he had a divine inspiration from God and that there was corruption in the royal family in Saudi Arabia, and he attacked and took the Holy Mosque in Mecca. And from talking to Saudis who were alive at that time, again, this was before Twitter, before social media, there was very little information in the beginning about what had happened, but a deep fear of what was going on. It would be like people taking the Vatican and saying, you know, we're holding it. And through that crisis, again, there was not much information that came out right away. Slowly information came out, and they eventually, the Saudis, with the help of, I believe, the French, retook the mosque. But in the trauma that happened after that, again, it was like an early sign of different types of belief systems coming into conflict with each other. Initially, the Saudi response at the time was, again, to become more conservative, not knowing how to deal with this type of threat, because the challenger, the folks who had taken the Holy Mosque, were saying, we have the true Islam. We are right, and the Saudi government is corrupt. So this current situation we're in right now is not the first time this has happened. And again, one thing that struck me when I first got there and meeting people, we in our country are analytical, and so we always want to make boxes and analytical charts of who's doing what. And when I got there, they referred to this as Islam itself. So they don't look at sex and belief systems at thinking that Wahhabis is something unique. They grew up with this, and so their image is this is Islam itself.
But they don't seem to respect other interpretations of Islam.
A key challenge, and again, this is what's going on right now. I want to kind of diverge a minute to the education program, because one of the intriguing things is, no doubt what you're saying, that one of the challenges for them to confront is the very notion of tolerance, live and let live. They have a religious position with some rhetoric to that effect, but in terms of the day-to-day existence, it's very controlled. Now, given that context of that type of rigidity, the strength of the ideological, the religious point of view, what struck me then is amazing, if you think of it this way, that King Abdullah, when he became king, started this program to say all these students would get full scholarships to go to other countries all around the world, not just the United States, to China, to Europe, wherever. That aspect was fascinating to me because he was essentially exposing this next generation to other cultures, to other interpretations even of Islam. If they come to this country, they're going to meet other Muslim students who do not have their particular orientation. And so that's why I think Carol Murphy and I, who wrote the article together, she had done a small book looking at the attitudes of 20-somethings when she was posted to Riyadh. And I think we both came away with this fascination with the idea that I think in the United States right now we have around 100,000 Saudi students, men and women.
Okay, but are they going beyond the fields of science, technology, engineering, medicine, right, and math? Because this is what you say in your article, mm-hmm, that, in fact, yes, this is a tremendous effort on the part of the late King Abdullah. It remains to be seen to what extent this will continue under Salman and so forth. But the way critical minds are developed are through the social sciences and history and philosophy and so forth. Are they allowed to study these topics overseas, or are they prohibited from doing that?
There's a general expansion of this. There are two girls I know right now who are going into law, for example. But one thing that my husband talks about, and I think this is true, and this happened right when we lived there, the advent of social media and Twitter, the way of communicating. Obviously, we can see in terms of ISIS the negative impact that allows people to get together for evil purposes. But the thing that struck me at the time when it started is that it opened the door to knowledge in a way that Saudis couldn't control, for one thing. And I remember talking to a number of Saudi friends of mine about the free courses that Harvard offers and MIT called edX. You can take courses online right now for free anywhere in the world. So the entire picture of education, I think, can no longer be put in a box. So I see we're in the middle of a transition period right now.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Janet Breslin-Smith. She's a former professor of national security strategy and former senior staffer on Capitol Hill. She's currently launching Crosswinds Strategy Consulting and assisting Saudi women professionals in career development. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA corruption correspondent Jeffrey Young. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can send feedback via email as well to pcusa@voanews.com. Here's a shout-out to a faithful listener, Al-Bashir Yakubo from northeastern Nigeria. Well, let me turn to Jeffrey Young for a question for Janet.
Ms. Smith, in looking at the transition between Abdullah and Zalman, you spoke before the beginning of the program that so far the status quo in these educational programs appears to continue. Would you like to delve into Zalman himself and his background and his present condition and the questions that that raises regarding who really governs Saudi Arabia at this point? Many public reports verify that this man has dementia. Therefore, he's a figurehead. There's other people that are obviously running KSA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Who are these people?
And, you know, to what extent does this transition mirror, you know, what you're listening to vis-a-vis other Saudis, women and men, about this juncture we're at with respect to the rise of the so-called Islamic State? Are there reflections about this connection between the monarchy and the Wahhabi clerics?
Well, let me address Jeff's question first and then kind of move into the other. From what I've seen, the king made an announcement of a change in his cabinet. He is combining the Ministry of Higher Education with the Ministry of Education to make one department. I note that a lot of the people he has appointed are people with a business background. And significantly, a lot of them are much younger people, because the criticism or the observation has been over the years that these were very elderly men. King Abdullah was over 90, although I have to say was, until the very latter years, was very intellectually engaged and coming up with new ideas all the time. But Jeff's right. King Salman was people who take positions in Saudi Arabia have them for a long period of time. I think he was mayor of Riyadh for 40 years. So given those kind of positions, I think it is significant that he's chosen some younger men and taking a business background to that. He's only really been in position for a few weeks now in terms of this new cabinet, so it's kind of early to say what policy changes are going to happen in any particular area. Again, I look at education more than anything else, but they've made changes over the years in agriculture and really trying to work on the issue of stopping subsidies and stopping the effort to try to grow their own crops, since water is such a scarce and valuable commodity over there. It's difficult to know right now on your issue, Carol, about where the clerical leadership is going to be. The question is, if for some reason ISIS and Daesh turned around and made an attack on Saudi Arabia, no person there, nobody in the clerical leadership or anywhere else, would be immune from attack, because Daesh is considered the entire kingdom to be not pure enough for them. So I think the notion that you alluded to yourself about coming around this issue, is coming around to bite them or to look them in the face, presents them with an interesting dilemma. What are they going to do about this?
Do they actually recognize the linkage themselves, that they are part of the problem, that their interpretation of Islam, which they see as the interpretation, is actually part of the problem?
You know, whenever you live in a foreign country, it gives you the opportunity not only to learn a new culture, but to reflect on your own. And in the 4 years we lived there, I remember feeling that not only was I really being exposed to this culture that so challenged my assumptions and so was so different than my expectations of how I thought people would think through a problem. And it made me realize how different our approach was. So it's hard to answer your question about how are they going to respond. The culture itself and the way you're raised from being a child, it reminds me of how I remember my Catholic cousins in the 50s, where you had a very strict nun as a teacher and a very strong adherence to a certain interpretation of the Catholic faith. A lot of focus on sin, day of judgment, punishment. The Atlantic article that came out recently about what ISIS wants, I think captures some of that feel personally when you hold on tight to a religion and you're afraid to let it go. And so this ISIS threat right now is, to me, forcing a crack in that rigid holding on to say, what is it here that these children of ours, if I was a Saudi parent, are going in a direction that is of such deep concern to them. In many, many ways, this has nothing to do with us. We're watching a deep and profound question internally for both parents, grandparents, and children, as well as the government. In other words, I'm trying to look at it from a personal point of view. I can tell from talking to friends that this is a moment of deep, deep and profound questioning.
Do you see it that way, Jeffrey? Because the way you put it was the kingdom is in existence, that is the monarchy exists and prevail as long as they
you know, toe the line of the radical clerics. So
this has been a tacit understanding since 1935. So is this 80 years operative fact?
So is this understanding now about to unravel potentially as the monarchy sees? And if so, what does that mean? Does that mean the monarchy is in jeopardy? Or are the clerics going to be, told to listen, we've got to stop the promulgation of this particular theology because it's being used by groups like ISIS, the Islamic State, for very negative and violent ends?
Again, I would be curious myself to know how the clerical leadership and their Imam Muhammad University of Islamic Studies in Riyadh, I would be really curious to know what their faculty is thinking about right now. I know that there's a desire to maintain values. Again, stability. We talk about stability. They talk about stability. There is a deep fear, and I used to feel when I talked to Saudis that there was a general feeling that there were only two models in life of government. You either had an authority structure with however you could accommodate the religious connection to it, and I might even go back to the Roman Empire at the time where you had some relationships. But in Saudi, there always was this feeling that you had to have an authority structure of some sort, or you would have anarchy. And as they looked around the region, I mean, Syria, anarchy. Iraq right now, disarray. Egypt has come back to an authority structure, but their feeling is if they didn't have that, they would have disarray. So I have always had this sense in the last number of years that is this possibly a time, now with this new educated young generation coming up, is this a time for the development potentially of a new political theory that is indigenous and unique to them? I've always felt that our references to democracy, for example, makes total sense to us in our traditions, United States and in Europe. But in their culture and in their history and in their tribal structures, this possibly is a time to rethink alternatives to these two models of anarchy or strong will. And is this a time, is this crisis right now, not just forcing a reflection on theology, which is aspect of what you're talking about, but I'm saying, is there a potential here to open the door to reconsider the problems throughout the region, which are the most basic questions of humankind? How do two groups live together, near each other, without killing each other? So justice, order, those ideas of mankind, I think this ISIS thing is pushing on a plate to be considered.
And do you think it would push as far as to allow Riyadh and Tehran, for example, to cooperate since they have a common interest in defeating the so-called Islamic State?
Geostrategic issues continue on. The only thing I'm trying to add in this discussion is that that's all true. I mean, great power politics are great power politics. Underneath it, though, and when you read Lolita in Tehran, women in Iran and women in Saudi Arabia are entering this world of greater exposure than either culture had in the past. So women traditionally were at home. My curiosity and my fascination is, in the midst of all this geostrategic stuff that Jeff could talk about much better than me, this other phenomena is happening. And it's happening with education, it's happening with exposure, with travel, everything else, and with business acumen. So my question about the future is, again, in addition to this, the mess in the region and the specific theological struggle, is how does this other dynamic play out? Because you know the Saudi Arabia is a gender-segregated society. You can't avoid this when you're there. How does that dynamic affect these other political structures?
And Jeffrey, do you have another question for Janet?
Back to power. The Islamic State has now targeted Saudia because it's impure. But this is all a ruse. The truth of it is power. Al-Baghdadi and his inner circle in Daesh, they are power-hungry people. They are seizing power and controlling it.
No question, right? When people are in a position of authority, we talk about power, and that is a dynamic. There's no question about that. And by the way, I've had interesting discussions with Saudi on this issue with the women who had been appointed to the Shura Council, part of the group who are advisors to the king. And when they had all been selected, I had a dinner at my house with a number of them. And I was talking about the fact that, again, under my fascination with, is this a time where they may develop and come in some creative period to their own political theory? And I talked about the issue of power, and that in our society, we have come to a truism about this, that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's something that most people say, yes, I've seen that. A Saudi response would be power is a factor, but that Islam counters that. If you are a good Muslim, you will not be corrupt. And my rejoinder to that is, what do you do if you're not a good Muslim? And what are the structures you might be able to think about to address that problem, if we both acknowledge it, that that's a problem. That's the point where I think they are right now. How do you think about these issues in light of the fact of looking around you in this region? And again, it's on their border. If you were living in Saudi Arabia right now, you are surrounded with chaos, anarchy, challenge, and then this personal being the target, really, of this group. For them, it's beginning a long, long period of earth-shaking reflection.
Well, let's hope that's the case. And again, to the question of to what extent this earth-shaking reflection would allow them, that is the Saudis and their Wahhabi doctrine, to make common cause with Tehran over trying to beat back the rise of ISIL, mm-hmm. the Islamic State.
We use words like Wahhabist and Salafist. When I read it, it has to do with whatever that quality is that you feel that you cannot express a feeling or an idea, an opinion, unless you have a verse in the Quran to support your position. So when we talk about fundamentalist Christians or people who believe that I have to have a Bible verse to express myself, that is kind of their incoming position, that need to fundamentally link to the direct words in the Quran or in the Hadith. Right now, there's a word for this called ijtihad. Can you reason from that? Can you reason from those foundations? Again, that's to me, they're on the verge of considering that. Not just in Saudi Arabia, I'm talking about the Islamic world in general.
Janet Breslin-Smith is a public policy and national security strategy expert with more than 30 years of experience in public service. She is currently assisting Saudi women professionals in career development and is writing a book with her husband, the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, about their years in the kingdom. Well, Janet Breslin-Smith, we just touched the surface. We hope to have you back for another conversation.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you
so much. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. Joining me on the program was VOA corruption correspondent Jeffrey Young. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.